The first case on the calendar is Tapia versus Dakota County Sheriff, and you may proceed at this time.
Thank you, Your Honor.
Please introduce yourself and let us know who you're representing before you begin your oral argument.
May it please the court. My name is Stephen Budke, and I represent Mr. Benjamin Tapia in his appeal and in his request for a writ of mandamus from the district court instructing the Dakota County Sheriff to issue him a permit to carry.
Could I start with the classic question of what is our standard of review relative to this matter?
We are looking at statutory interpretation, and that would be de novo review.
As to the writ of mandamus, the denial of a writ of mandamus?
Well, our position is that the court simply relied on an incorrect interpretation of the statute, and that served as the sole basis for the denial. So it would only be statutory interpretation, de novo review, with no deference to the district court and their determination on that legal conclusion. Thank you. Individuals who are convicted of crimes of violence are prohibited from possessing a firearm for the remainder of their life under the current rendition of the statute. Crimes of violence are all statutorily defined. We don't have to look beyond the statute to determine whether or not somebody has been convicted of a crime of violence. It's an exhaustive list. Prior to 2014, theft of a motor vehicle was listed as a crime of violence in the statute. Also prior to 2014, in 1998, Mr. Tapia was adjudicated delinquent for theft of a motor vehicle. That rendered him, at the time, prohibited from possessing a firearm. In 2014, the legislature sought fit to remove theft of a motor vehicle and third-degree burglary from the crime of violence statute.
Counsel, why is that statute ambiguous? You apparently think it is, correct?
I do not believe it's I believe that there might have been ambiguity in it at one point until this court cleared that up for us in a case called State versus Schluter. Okay. In Schluter, Mr. Schluter was convicted of a controlled substance offense.
So it's a crime conviction, not a written mandamus involving a gun permit.
I'm sorry.
It's distinguishable as a crime conviction.
Schluter was a criminal conviction, but I would argue that that is a distinction without a difference in this situation, because a person's gun rights are their gun rights. Whether a person is prohibited is an on-off switch. They can't be prohibited only in a criminal context, but not in a civil context, and vice versa. The question is whether or not a person is currently prohibited and subject to criminal prosecution as a result of it, and if he's not,
okay,
then the sheriff must issue
a permit. All right,
but
it also is distinguishable in that at the time that he admitted to the underlying crime, it was not a crime of violence, correct?
In Mr. Schluter's case, that's correct.
Yes, and in this case, it was.
It is correct. And the reason that I am arguing that this court should rely on that same analysis is because in the subsequent Schluter 2, Mr. Schluter filed a subsequent post-conviction appeal on a separate matter, and this court issued an unpublished opinion where they clarified their position in Schluter that said, fundamental to our analysis in the direct appeal is the determination that the, quote, offenses committed on or after, end quote, the statute's effective date refers to the offense of possessing the firearm, not the predicate offense for which the prohibition applies. That can be flipped. In the parenthetical following that passage, the Court of Appeals wrote, the illegal act was possessing the firearm in 2000, not the possession of LSD in 1986. If we apply that same logic to this case, we could say the illegal act would be possessing a firearm prior to August 1st, 2014, not the theft of a motor vehicle in 1998.
But here's my problem with your argument, because we have a statute, Minnesota Statute 645.21, which says no law shall be construed to be retroactive unless clearly and manifestly so intended by the legislature. And in this case, we have the legislature saying specifically that it's effective as of August 1, 2014 and applies to crimes committed on or after that date. You're in effect arguing that somehow that this statute, which did remove the auto theft, it can somehow be utilized retroactively to make it what was a crime of violence into a crime that is not a crime of violence.
I'm actually arguing that...
That's not... And how can we look at those two statutes and basically make them consistent with each other?
I appreciate the question because that is what we initially grappled with, and Schluter is what overcame that for us. Because in that case, Mr. Schluter argued, when I was convicted of possessing LSD, it was not a crime of violence. Therefore, if I am now subject to a lifetime prohibition, or at that point, a 10-year prohibition, then the court is effectively, retroactively modifying my sentence. It is increasing the consequences. And the Court of Appeals in Schluter said, no, we are not amending the sentence. We are not increasing consequences. Gun control laws are simply that. They control who can possess a firearm. And we are looking only at the current state. Mr. Tapia, we are not asking the court to resentence or remove a prohibition or do anything like that. What we're doing is saying that the legislature gets to define what class of people can and cannot possess a firearm at any given moment. In Mr. Schluter's case, when he was convicted, he was not subject to that prohibition. He was not a member of that class that the legislature said was prohibited. The legislature then amended the statute, and he now became a member of that class at that moment. If they would remove controlled substances from the definition of crimes of violence now, he would no longer be subject to it, because all we care about is the current rendition of the statute. I believe that is what this court has found in Schluter. It also is the answer that makes the most sense. The legislature does not intend absurd results. An individual adjudicated delinquent of an offense in 1998 would be prohibited, but an individual who committed it last month would not be. That's an absurd result. The way we get around that is by following the logic that this court employed in Schluter. We look at the current.
But I mean, and I understand what occurred in Schluter, but aren't we in effect here making what was a lifetime ban into no ban at all? Wouldn't that be a retroactive action that is not clearly made, is not clear under the legislative amendment?
In no more way than what happened in Schluter. I mean, it's got to work both ways, Your Honors. In Schluter, the defense actually tried to argue that it was a retroactive modification. And they said, unless the legislature specifically intends for that, you cannot increase punishment. You cannot retroactively apply this. That was their argument. And the Court of Appeals said, no, that is not what happened. You simply became a member of a class of people that the legislature said there is a link between this offense and gun violence, therefore you are prohibited.
So your argument is the current, whatever definition is in effect that the legislature decides is a crime that should disqualify someone from carrying a weapon, that applies to everybody, no matter what their status was under a previous law. So you're arguing it's not retroactive, you're looking at the current definition.
That is exactly
and
correct.
And if next year the legislature adds back in the crime which your client was originally adjudicated delinquent, he will no longer qualify for a permit. Is that right?
That is correct. Under Schluter, I would be without any legal authority to argue the opposite. We would be filing a petition for restoration of gun rights. This fact was also conceded, actually, at the district court level when the court asked whether or not somebody, for example, in 2014, the legislature also added domestic assault strangulation into the statute. Under Schluter, a person who was convicted of that at a time that it wasn't in the statute, so 2013, it was conceded that that person would be prohibited now because the current statute says so. That logic has to work both ways. If we're looking at the current version of the statute, we have to do it in every situation. It also makes sense when we're talking about enforcement of the law. If we tasked law enforcement officers with looking at not only the current statute, but also every previous version of the statute, as well as the comments to those statutes, enforcement would be unreasonably tedious. It also runs afoul of any notice requirement. Ignorance of the law is not a defense. We hear that all the time. If an individual can't go look at the statute, the current definition of crimes of violence, and rely on that, then that is not adequate notice, and that's not what our justice system is supposed to do.
Well, I mean, one thing that existed in Schluter that we don't have here is Schluter was basically saying that his prior conviction, that because of, they changed the nature of his prior conviction, that he was basically getting ex post facto punishment.
Correct.
And we don't have that here, correct?
Correct. The court rejected his ex post facto argument.
Right.
And I would, I again, if the situation was reversed and theft of a motor vehicle was added back into the statute, I would not attempt to make that argument before the court. And I believe the court in Schluter with the ex post facto argument actually spent a fair amount of time explaining why that didn't apply. Even I believe that.
But in this case, there's not even an argument, correct?
Correct. We're simply asking.
Facto punishment.
Correct. We're simply asking.
It is distinguishable, at least factually, from Schluter in that regard.
There are several factual distinctions between Schluter and Mr. Tapia's case. There are no legal distinctions in my mind. That is the point that I want to emphasize. Mr. Schluter's case was very different. His offense was added into the statute. His was a criminal case. All of those are facts. The legal status of an individual and with respect to the right to possess a firearm, that does not change based on those factual distinctions.
So you would infer based on Schluter that had Mr. Schluter, rather than possessing a crime, had sought a permit to carry, he would have been denied because under the law current at that time, he didn't qualify.
Correct.
So, and you're saying, conversely, when the law changes here, you apply the current law and you grant the permit if the legislature has decided it's not a crime of violence that should disqualify.
Correct. The state cannot have their cake and eat it too. It has to work both ways. And
what we don't know, and I guess I will hear from the state, is whether, in fact, Schluter, and, you know, I have a question about that, or the sheriff's office, whether Schluter had, Mr. Schluter had sought a permit if he would have been denied. Otherwise, it would be odd that he could be criminally prosecuted but not get a permit. And that's, like, the question. I mean, is there any argument that he could be criminally prosecuted for possessing without a permit and at the same time be denied a permit?
I'm glad Your Honor brings that up because that appears to be implicit in the district court's order when they make this distinction between criminal and civil, that somehow if Mr. Tapia were to disregard the law, or disregard the court's order anyways, go possess a firearm and be charged, well, he would be acquitted because he's not subject to that prohibition and therefore couldn't be criminally prosecuted, but somehow could not get a permit to carry. And that's what I mean when I say that gun rights are gun rights. It's an on-off toggle.
Because it's the same statutes.
Correct.
It's 7.714, 0.713, 0.712.
Correct.
I want to come back to the context in which this matter has come to us, and it's a denial of writ of mandamus.
Yes.
And as I understand the law, in order to get a writ of mandamus, where the district court is actually commanding or ordering another government official to do an act, it has to be an act that's clearly imposed by law. And here we're arguing about what the law is. So I don't know, I mean, how can the district court, in light of basically what may be unsettled law here, impose its will upon another government official in light of this uncertainty regarding what the law is?
Any uncertainty at this point is self-imposed because this court has told us that when that the honor before language and honor after language refers to the crime of possessing a firearm when your status says you're prohibited. It does not refer to the predicate offense. That confusion and ambiguity in the statute would be present if this court hadn't already explained it. We are in a position where we have case law that clearly spells out whether or not that language is referring to the predicate offense or the crime of being in possession. Simply put, that language means that if Mr. Tapia had been found with a firearm on July 30th, 2014, and the state chose to charge him, his case does not get dismissed on August 1st because it was removed from the statute. That's what they mean by that. This refers to crimes committed on or before August 1, 2014. An individual who was a prohibited person and found to be in possession prior to that date is still subject to being prosecuted as a prohibited person in possession of a firearm. If That same individual had a firearm on August 1st, 2014. They are no longer subject to criminal prosecution. That's what Schluter tells us that language means. And that's why Mr. Tappy is not prohibited. I see I'm running out of time, so I'll save any further comments for rebuttal. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you.
May it please the court, I'm Helen Brosnahan, and I represent respondent Dakota County Sheriff Tim Leslie. This case presents a simple issue of statutory interpretation of whether the 2014 amendment to 624.712 is prospective or retrospective in its application. And it's long been held by both the courts in Minnesota and the legislature with its enactment of 645.21 as Judge Hooten has previously referenced, that laws in this state are prospective in application unless clearly and manifestly so intended by the legislature.
What's retroactive about looking at the current definition of crime of violence when someone comes in to get a permit? Why do you say that's a retro? Why looking at the current definition of crime of violence would be a retroactive application of law?
Because the legislature defined it as being effective on X date.
On August 1.
August 1 of 2014.
So let's say it's August 2nd, you come in to get a permit, August 2nd, 2014. This definition is in effect.
That's correct.
Why do you argue...
committed on or after August 1.
Okay, so you're reading that second part of the statute as crimes committed, applies to crimes committed on or after that date, as referring to the crimes in the definition of the crime of violence, as opposed to what I think the applicant would argue. No, I'm talking about when I'm actually charged with a crime of possession. So the crime could be the crime in the underlying definition, the predicate crime and crime of violence, or that language could apply to crimes committed on or after, referring to possession crimes, right?
It's referring to the definition of crimes of violence. It changed the definition of what is a crime of violence.
How do we know that the language applies to crimes committed after that date, on or after that date, refers to the predicate in... Well, here's what reason I ask. When we look at Schluter, okay, the underlying statutory change said this statute is effective following the day following an enactment. I think that's all it said. And Schluter read that to mean, let's look at the current new definition of crime of violence, but apply it only to a possession crime after the effective date. Okay. So this law is effective the day following. Schluter applied the changed, the amended definition of crime of violence. Okay. And now we have this that says this section is effective August 1, 2014, and applies to crimes committed after that date. So the legislature did change the effective date language. It added, and applies to crimes committed after that date, on or after that date. When I was thinking about this, I thought, why? Because Schluter, I mean, the effective date seems to be, well, you look at it as of now, not the underlying date. And crimes committed on or after that date arguably could be, we mean to actually codify what the Court of Appeals decided in Schluter, which is the possession crimes, not the definition of what a crime of violence is, but the possession crime.
Well, if the legislature meant that, it would have done what it did in 2003 when it previously amended the statute and did a retroactive application to crimes, people discharged or released from their sentence after August 1st or July, whatever the effective date of that was, of 1993. So they did a look back, and that was important because people whose status was in effect at that time, they had a 10-year prohibition, and they enlarged the prohibition to a lifetime prohibition. And so they were effectively eliminating an issue of individuals who rights were essentially going to be changed negatively if they went back to time and eternity for crimes forever because Up until that point, it was a 10-year. So the 2003 enactment was encompassing everybody that was still subject to the prohibition and then enlarging it too. And that's how Mr. Schluter got encompassed in this as well, because his conviction was in 1998 and his release was in 1999, well after the 1993 effective date enlarging the statute. So in this instance, if the legislature wanted to make the status change effective for all prior convicted felons, it would have done a retroactive application, at least back until that 2003 amendment.
What would have happened had the legislation that you're talking about that says, and is going to apply to not all past offenders, but to those within 10 years, right? I mean, it went retroactively back to certain, but not all. What if it had not included that language and had just said this change is effective as of, you know, the effective date of whatever year that was?
Then those individuals would have had an argument that they were having rights taken away from them essentially ex post facto. Because in this instance, Mr. Tapia's rights didn't change. His status didn't change. He was a prohibited person before the 2014 amendment, and he's a prohibited person after the 2014 amendment.
Didn't we reject ex post facto, though, in Schluter? Wasn't that what Schluter was about, is rejecting that argument?
Right. It was rejecting that argument, but I'm saying...
Even without that language. I mean, all the Schluter, the only language at issue at Schluter was this statute is effective the day following an enactment. You know, I mean, it didn't have any, like, retroactive. We just said it's not a ex post facto. I'm not sure exactly why ex post facto would come in the intervening one when it's not there in Schluter.
Well,
that's confusing to me.
But if your status doesn't change, the people in 2003, their status would have changed, right? Because they had previously had only a 10-year prohibition. And then if it would have gone retroactive beyond the 1993, the look back of the 10-year encompassing everybody that would have been subject to a 10-year prohibition at that point, because the 1993...
But Mr. Schluter had no prohibition for many years,
because, right?
Right,
because he was before the various amendments. But his status changed. So the Schluter issue was whether or not he... The legislature and the courts were changing his criminal penalty. And that's not what is occurring with the status change of your prohibited or not prohibited from possessing firearms. It's your status of whether or not you can possess a firearm, not whether or not you can be punished more severely. And that's what Schluter was arguing, is that, look, I'm getting an extra penalty because this wasn't in effect at the time I was convicted.
Right, and the state in his case applied the amended definition to him, right?
I believe so, yes.
Right, it had to have, mm-hmm. because he wasn't disqualified,
right,
and then he was. So it applied the amended definition. And then here you're arguing do not apply the amended definition because that would be a retroactive application.
Because it would be a retroactive application, and the legislature didn't intend that.
If I commit a crime, like in this case, I commit a crime which is a crime of violence, mm-hmm. you know, in January. Next year, the legislature amends it to remove it, similar. And, you know, on August 1 and on September 1, I'm found in possession of a gun. Will I be charged with being an ineligible person? Am I an ineligible person? And which definition of crime of violence do we apply?
If the legislature removed it, did it remove it before or after?
August 1. So August 1, it removes it. In September, I'm found with a weapon.
We're in exactly the same position today that Mr. Tapia is arguing it's a retroactive application.
So,
is the language in the legislature?
Would I be charged?
Would I
be charged with the crime of ineligible person?
You would be charged with the crime of ineligible person,
even though at the point I possess a gun, it's not a crime of violence. Okay, I commit the crime now, it's a right. crime of violence. The legislature removes it and decides, no, that's no longer disqualifying, and then I have a gun.
Right.
Okay, and under and the thing, part of the issue here, I think that's difficult, is the same statute governs, same exact provisions govern the crime of possession as well as your right to get a permit. Okay, so we're looking at the exact same statutes, the right. definition, the disqualifier, and so on.
Right.
So commit a crime of violence that disqualifies me. August 1, the legislature changes, says no, we no longer think that's sufficiently tied to whatever, right. having a gun. It's no longer a crime of violence. The following month, I possess a gun. Am I an ineligible person in possession of a weapon? Which definition do we look at? The definition at the time I committed the crime or the definition that's then in effect?
Based on the prior jurisprudence, you would, for purposes of a criminal prosecution, you would look at the time in effect.
Okay. So I could not be charged.
You could not be charged, but you likely would not be eligible and that, for a permit.
Okay. And to not be eligible for the permit, you say that for that, we no longer look at the current definition. We look at the definition at the time of the predicate crime. And your argument for doing that is the language that says, not the effective date, because we all know it went into effect on August 1, mm-hmm. but the part and applies to crimes committed on or after that date. It's that language that you think means. I'm having trouble understanding why there's a difference in applying the current statute based on that effective date language into criminal prosecution. You know, I do it without seeking a permit, or I'm law-abiding and I go seek a permit. I'm having trouble understanding why one's retroactive and one's not, and why the statute requires it in one and not the other.
The legislature is making a policy decision as to whether or not somebody should face criminal penalties versus whether or not somebody who has past prior conduct should be eligible to have a permit to carry a concealed weapon.
But it's all the same definition, and you're looking at the same effective date language for both, right? I mean, there's no other statute that we're looking at besides 0.713 and 0.712 and
right, but for the eligible determination for whether or not you're eligible to possess a firearm, you have to have a predicate conviction versus whether or not you are charged with a crime. There's no predicate conviction required. You have to right? You know, so you have to be possessing it as an ineligible person. So
right, but the ineligibility in Schluter was exactly right, 0.713 and the definition of crime of violence, the exact same statute.
But the legislature has made a demarcation and said for crimes committed on or after this date, meaning the criminal conduct is different from whether or not you are an ineligible person. So possessing the firearm would have been a crime if they didn't change it, right? So I have a prior conviction that prohibited me, so I'm an ineligible person. The legislature doesn't change anything, and I possess a firearm. It's a crime for me to possess a firearm. So the act of me possessing the firearm is what is the criminal act, right? Because I'm a prohibited person.
Right. But now, if I'm
between,
prohibited under the
right,
definition
between,
of the...
If they then enact a statute and they say it's effective on or after X date, and on after X date, I possess the firearm, it's not a crime because it's not defined as a crime any longer because...
Right, you look at the current definition of crime. It's no longer defined as a crime.
Is, but that doesn't change my status of whether or not the legislature has defined me as an ineligible person.
Except how would you ever enforce the gun laws then? If you're saying it doesn't affect whether you're an ineligible person if you can never charge them because it's no longer recognized under the statute.
Well, no, it's whether or not you have a permit to carry. You're ineligible to have a permit to carry, right? There's a difference between a permit to carry and enforcing the gun laws.
If there is a charge, then it would have to be for failure to have a permit.
Right.
Okay, all right.
So it's a status issue, and the legislature didn't change Mr. Tapia's status. They changed what the crime is for being illegally possessing a firearm.
So in other words, when the legislature passed the statute, they didn't mean to change at the same time everyone's status.
Correct.
For carrying a weapon.
Right. And the legislature knew that individuals in Mr. Tapia's position have a remedy available to them. He could have just as easily sought restoration, which is a better remedy for him because it permanently changes his status. He chose not to do that.
And that's under 609.165.
Correct.
Since this is a writ of mandamus, is he required to exhaust his legal remedies before requesting a writ of mandamus?
Yes. However, I would point out to the court that in 624.714, subdivision 12B, the analysis for if you're going to treat this as his petition for review of a denial of a permit, which I'm not sure that's exactly what he did, but then the sheriff had to prove by clear and convincing evidence that he was an ineligible individual. The district court found that he was an ineligible individual. And so I would ask this court, I see my time has run out, and so I would ask this court to uphold the decision of the district court and follow colleague's decision in the Jackson case.
Can I ask one more question? So to understand how this would operate going forward, let's say now we're 10 years out and the legislature has changed the definition, let's say, you know, five more times. So is the way that it would have to work for a sheriff to grant a permit, is the sheriff then needs to look at the date of the predicate crime, match it to what the statute was at the time? What do we do with successive statutes that might or might not have different language at the end as to how and whether it has applied, as you would say, retroactively or not? It seems like quite a task to put on a sheriff to do that legislative history research to understand whether a current definition, or maybe you only have to look at the most current one. I'm just thinking of the trouble in administrating a program that depends on the legislative analysis of changes in effective date, or what the meaning of the effective date.
I would say that the sheriffs are currently doing that, so it wouldn't change the process at all. It's how it worked when the legislature changed it in 2003 with looking back to see when the individual was released from sentence. Was it before 1993 or after the 1993 effective date? In this instance, when Sheriff Leslie's staff looked at it from once they obtained all of the relevant records, they looked at it and said, well, he's an ineligible person because he has this prior conviction, and the effective date of the 2014 amendment was not retroactive like it was in 2003 with the look back. So they're currently doing that.
So they
already
should have looked at, rather than find it out later, on the face of it at the first moment, should have looked at the 2014 statute, looked at the effective date, and decided that his crime continued to disqualify him.
Right, and that didn't happen because at the time the BCA didn't provide access to juvenile adjudications. And then in 2018, in the winter, early spring of 2018, that process changed and sheriffs then were given access to juvenile adjudications, which resulted in the normal review process for individuals with permits on the audits. If you look at Dewana Witt's the addendum exhibit that the respondent has to its brief, that's what triggered it, is the audit, normal audit procedure, and it was discovered because they had access to those records that they didn't have when Mr. Tapia originally applied. Had they had that access when he originally applied and was granted a permit that was void upon issuance because he was ineligible, he would have never gotten it.
All right. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Counsel, I have a question, if I could just ask you.
Certainly.
A focus that I have that's a little different than what we're talking about. If I'm charged with a crime, and by admitting to the crime or being convicted of that crime, I know that I'm going to be ineligible, and that occurs, And then years later, the crime that I'm convicted of becomes a crime where you're not ineligible. Why can't the legislature make that distinction 20, 30 years later? What's wrong with that? Why can't they do that and say that, I'm sorry, you are ineligible. You knew it at the time. That was the thought of our people in the state of Minnesota at the time, and you're ineligible. Now, we have a new generation. In the future, we don't think when you're convicted of that, you should be ineligible. But that doesn't mean that you in the past become immediately eligible. And that's our decision, and we don't make it retroactive. Then the legislature do that, and if not, why not?
They can do that. They didn't.
Well, that's your reading of the statute.
That's my reading of the statute based on the Schluter analysis, and the analysis that was supported by the state here is not supported by anything other than their desired outcome. We can rely on the language in Schluter that talks about the predicate offense versus the...
Well, except that I keep coming back to Schluter. First, it was a criminal conviction, but I agree that the statute applies both. But second, it's the opposite. He was not on notice that this could occur to him. The applicant here was on notice that he'd be ineligible. He went forward believing he was ineligible. And so he feels like something's been taken away from him because a future group was found eligible for being convicted of the same crime.
Certainly. I understand what you're saying, and there's just no legal justification for that sort of denial in Mr. Tapia's case. I certainly understand the point that's being made. What I'm hoping has been made abundantly clear is that, as Judge Smith had pointed out, the statute in a civil and criminal context, we're talking about the exact same statute. Those words have to have the same meaning. The sky is blue in a criminal situation and a civil situation.
Well, let's talk about that, because, the state has made an explanation of this matter by saying that for purposes of determining if someone's committed a new crime, as we do with all criminal offenses, we look at what the statute says at the time of the commission of the crime, right?
Correct.
Now, that's one, and that's our, I mean, I think that's just well-established law. But that does not mean for purposes of getting a gun permit that this statute, which did change the law regarding what constitutes a crime, retroactively changed everyone's status.
There is no legal authority that has been cited for the proposition that there is a difference in being able to be prosecuted as an ineligible person and getting a permit to carry. The sheriff is instructed under the statute to deny a permit to carry if a person is ineligible to possess a firearm, or there's a separate provision if they're a threat to public safety. That was never argued.
But
the status as an ineligible person is true in a criminal context, and it's true in a civil context.
But they're different things, though. I mean,
they are not.
In one context, we're talking about a civil right, the right to carry a gun, and the other context, we're talking about charging someone under a statute in effect on the date of their crime.
And respectfully, there is not a difference in the status of that individual. If an individual cannot be prosecuted for being an ineligible person in possession of a firearm because the predicate requirement that they are ineligible...
Is there any case you can cite us to that says that if you change a criminal statute, that change, even though it's not clearly retroactive, in fact, it very specifically says it goes forward, that changes someone's status for civil matters. Is there any case you can cite us to?
No, and because that is not quite what's at issue here. What's at issue here is not the criminal charging statute. The statute that we're talking about with this honor after or honor before language is not the criminal charging statute. It is the statute that defines whether a person has been convicted of a crime of violence. That is simply one of the elements that would have to be proven by the state.
Then you believe the statute then retroactively redefines whether your client, even though it's been judicially found that at the time of this theft of an automobile, that was a crime of violence?
Unequivocally, no. We are not asking that this court find any retroactivity. Well, if Mr. Tapia had been in possession of a firearm prior to 2014 and after his adjudication in 1998, he would be subject to criminal sanctions. What we are saying is the current version of the statute, as we sit here today, does not prohibit him. The state conceded that he could not be prosecuted for being an ineligible person, and if he can't be prosecuted for being an ineligible person, it's because he's not an ineligible person, which means the sheriff was required to issue the permit to carry.
All right. And fairness to you, you're close to being done, but I think we gave the state at least 3 extra minutes. So I have another question for you.
Thank you.
And that's with regard to the state's argument that this is an extraordinary remedy that you raised with the district court, and that you had another route you could have gone. You could have brought an action under 609.165 and shown good cause why your client, making your very eloquent arguments, has shown good cause as to why they should carry. Why isn't that a correct argument?
That's what I had hoped to spend this 5 minutes talking about,
okay.
So I appreciate
okay,
that, Your
good.
Honor. We file petitions under 609.165 subdivision 1D on a weekly basis. That statute gives the court more discretion than any statute I've ever seen. It says the court may restore somebody's right to possess a firearm if it finds good cause to do so, and this court has never overturned a district court's decision. I could have a judge come in and find that Mr. Tapia is the most amazing person on the planet. He volunteers with every organization, and he is not a threat at all. And he should totally have his guns back. We're denying him. That is a legally justifiable position.
But doesn't that cut the other way? I mean, you might find a judge who is very receptive to
absolutely.
Your arguments. Absolutely.
But I should not have to take that risk. The other very practical consideration is that's costly. You have to hire an attorney if you want to have a shot at making that argument, because very few people are aware of that law. Most courts, when I go and argue it in greater Minnesota, they've never even seen it. We're showing it to them for the first time. There's a risk there. There's a cost. With this particular statute, the permit should have been issued. Because it wasn't issued, we filed a writ of mandamus because the legislature wanted the sheriff to get the decision right. They did not want them arbitrarily denying people when they couldn't. So they enacted a mandatory attorney's fees provision with the writ of mandamus. So Mr. Tapia could take the risk that a court could deny him, and he would foot the entire cost for that. Or he can come in and say, the sheriff had no legal authority to deny me, and as a result of that, the legislature says they have to reimburse me my attorney's fees. They're
all
very...
Right. Well, okay, then I just want to go, because I'm just looking at this, and tell me, because it says, for which there is no other adequate legal remedy. Now, you've given me a lot of probably very good lawyerly reasons why you went this route, but how do you satisfy that element of when you can bring a writ of mandamus?
Because
there is another remedy.
There is not. That is the distinction that I hope this court can recognize.
But you're just assuming that a court would never fine.
No, I apologize. I jumped a few steps ahead instead of answering the question. I answered a practical answer as opposed to the legal. I apologize. Legally, the court does not have jurisdiction to hear a 609-165 subdivision 1D petition. It is predicated on an individual being prohibited and ineligible from possessing a firearm. That is our hook to get into court. The individual has to be prohibited. Because Mr. Tapia is not prohibited under the current rendition of the statute, the court had no legal authority to even hear that petition. So that remedy would not be available to us.
Okay.
I understand people would prefer we take that route, but legally speaking, it's not appropriate.
Okay. And you've got 4 extra minutes.
So. I appreciate
right, thank
that.
Thank you. And we usually don't extend this long, but this is a very interesting case and very well briefed and argued, and we appreciate your arguments today. They help us.
Thank you, Your Honors.
Deal with these issues. The next matter is the case versus Schuessen versus Schuessen. And I hope I'm saying the name correctly. If I'm not, please let me know. Counsel, you each have 15 minutes for your oral arguments this morning. The appellant will have 5 minutes for rebuttal. Please introduce yourself prior to beginning your oral arguments.